Welcome to Confessions of a Staff Psychologist. Today, I am chatting with Dr. Adam Gilpin about media technology and the digital family. Adam is a senior lecturer in psychology specializing in media psychology at the University of Salford, with a particular focus on technology use and design. He also has an interest in family media use and the psychological aspects of prosthetic arm use. Welcome, Adam. So delighted to have you on board.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Adam, before we start chatting about the work you do, can you tell me a little more about who you are, what you do, and what the pivot point was that sent you down the road of staff psychology?
So I'm a lecturer in psychology at the University of Salford. I've actually been there for 18 years. Let's go back right almost to the beginning. I did my PhD at Nottingham University, and I was in a cognitive psychology lab there, and I was using eye tracking in my PhD, and my PhD was focused on the relationship between where we look and what we remember. And actually what I did in that PhD was I showed people lots of spot the difference puzzles, you know, when you've got the two side by side. And my participants had to look for differences. And I looked at the relationship between their kind of eye movement variables and when they were able to spot the difference and when they didn't spot the difference. Try explaining that to people outside of psychology. And they're like, what are you wasting your time doing spot the difference puzzles for? A couple of years later, after a postdoc, I got the job at Salford. And then a few years into that job, BBC announced that they were going to be moving several departments to Media City, and the Media City development was happening. And one of the things that they had been thinking about were methods for studying children's web usability. The challenge with children's web usability is that children are less able to articulate their needs and their behaviours than adults. And so some of the traditional methods you use for web usability aren't particularly successful with children. And one of the things they were thinking about was eye tracking, because it's a way of getting insight into where people are paying attention without relying on them being able to verbally report it. So then I did this really cool project with the BBC, exploring various methods for children's web usability, but also including eye tracking. This is probably a lot longer than you were intending. But then off the back of that, I started to be interested in the ways that we can use psychology in kind of to understand media and technology, and then realized there wasn't an existing master's program in media psychology. And it seemed like with the BBC moving up and interest in developing Media City, let's put a program together. So then designed a master's and have been running that since 2012, and that includes, here we go, this is where we get to, that includes a cyber psychology element, so the usability stuff, user experience, how we interact with technology, the effect of technology on us and on society, and those kind of questions.
And we're going to be diving into quite a few of those areas over the course of our conversation, but I want to start with your PhD work, because that really is the beginning of your journey, and specifically in eye tracking, and you looked at visual memory and perception. Can you talk about bit more about your work on eye tracking, specifically how visual perception and memory are linked and why it's so important to kind of understand that link?
So the thing that was really fascinating for me at the time, and there was a lot of research interest about this, was the fact that we, even though we have the experience that we're taking in a lot of details from the visual world, actually it's quite possible to make quite large changes or disruptions to the visual scene in front of us, and people under certain conditions won't notice those changes. And this is the phenomenon called change blindness. And it started to be investigated in the late 90s and was really kind of becoming quite a revolutionary kind of idea in cognitive psychology at the time that my PhD was going. So I was quite interested in the relationship between where people look and their attention and what information they're extracting when they look, and what information they're not extracting. So I was looking at very kind of fine-grained analysis of how long has somebody actually pointed their eyes at that object before they've moved on? And do they notice, and have they noticed that the next object they look at is different or not? And there are various differences that I might make to these objects that I was showing people, like the color or the shape or the orientation and things like that. And then mapping those to how long that they looked at the objects. And I think essentially the what this showed alongside a big body of research that had been growing since the 90s was that we don't have this kind of rich internal picture of the visual world. We extract information as and when we need it. We roam our eyes around. We extract bits of information, but not everything. We use it. We move on. My PhD sort of sat within that learning. And I think it seems sort of so obvious, but at the time, that idea was being revolutionized, I think, within cognitive psychology, that actually we don't build up this rich picture.
And that kind of goes back to a lot of the work that they do in the courtrooms around witness testimony, doesn't it? In terms of how much someone actually remembers from a crime scene or from an accident, they've got a very limited perspective on what actually happened.
Exactly, yeah. That's often one of the applications. You know, when people say, why do we need to know that? That is one of the real-world implications of this kind of work, yeah.
And then also on our memory, because obviously our memory is not fantastic and we don't always remember everything. So taking just one sense and just having that one sensory input has an impact on what we do and don't remember.
Of course, yeah.
And you also then spoke about the consulting work you did with the BBC, specifically related to usability tracking of children's media consumption. What are the main insights you gain from investigating how children kind of interact with TV screens and web-based platforms?
So that project was not so much about learning how children interacted. It was about developing methods that would help people to do web usability work with children. So we weren't trying to kind of track their behaviours as much as testing which methods gave us insights. So eye tracking was the kind of primary one we went in with, and it was quite interesting. So we were taking eye trackers into schools and we were getting the quite young children to interact with different platforms and games and things and eye tracking them at the same time. And we got quite interesting eye tracking data. I found that you can learn a lot from understanding where people look. But what was interesting about it is that when the kids were really excited, they were fidgeting loads in their chairs. They were kind of reaching towards the screen, almost trying to kind of get as close as possible to this game that they were playing. And then the eye tracking would be lost. So I think one of the kind of takeaways from that was that a range of different methods in sort of triangulation is, if you want to get a good idea of children's experiences with technology, eye tracking alone probably won't tell you everything you need to know. Body language is quite good, you know, unlike adults that try and keep themselves still and not try and show their emotional experiences so obviously, children are a bit less disinhibited. And then there are some, we learned about all kinds of cool methods. We didn't generate the methods, but we, you know, did a sort of scoping exercise and like smiley face-ometers where children can indicate whether they've enjoyed something or not. And actually, with very young children, a really kind of basic thing that is really useful is again, do you want to play that again? And that's a question that makes sense to them and gives them lots of answers. Something else which is really good is co-discovery. So you get pairs of children to play or use a website or play a game. And then, of course, they talk to each other. And that talking to each other is much more natural than them talking to, you know, you, this strange adult who's asking them questions about why they're doing what they're doing. But talking to each other, you get lots of insights. So that was the kind of thing we were looking at in that project, is like what is the best way of trying to understand how children are using tech.
How does that kind of translate now into how children engage with smartphones? And can we talk about uses and gratifications of smartphones in terms of why we use it and how we actually get any or what gratification we get from using it? And is there a difference in how they do that media consumption in terms of the uses and gratifications?
I mean, yeah, so smartphones obviously are their personal devices, and they're harder for you to work with it within a single screen with another person, although it, you know, people do, and children do gather around smart devices, and you know, they are still sharing content on the same screen, but they are much more personal, and they're, of course, they're connected. So a lot of what is done through smartphones is to communicate and interact with people who are dislocated somewhere else. So yeah, with the project we were looking at, we were using desktop technology, and smartphones were sort of taking off, but not really very widely used by young people. So the landscape has changed enormously since that work. And in terms of uses and gratifications, there's a wide variety of uses and gratifications. So entertainment, creativity, communication, learning, and different children will use their devices for different things at different times. I mean, they're like Swiss Army knives, aren't they? They different functions.
Do you think they kind of use their smartphones or kind of media differently? Because you spoke earlier about when the children are talking to each other or with each other when they're engaging with media, that was different to actually talking with being asked or answering questions from adults. Do you think that's shifted because smartphones generally are being used with their friends rather than sitting in front of a computer with an adult?
Yeah, so with the situation with the adult is in the context of doing a usability testing session.
Yeah.
So if you imagine that you're trying to understand children's web usability, traditional usability setup in a lab would be that you'd have a user and they've been sitting in front of a screen, and there'd be someone facilitating the session, kind of sat a bit behind them, say, you could open this web page, tell me what you think, articulate your thoughts as you're working through this site, try and find the red vacuum cleaner and put it in the basket and tell me what challenges you're facing as you're doing this task. For children, I think it's very difficult to get them to understand that context. It feels like a test. It's a weird adult. Why are you asking me this question? So that traditional think aloud method isn't very good, but children are used to working things out with each other. So that co-discovery is not about how children are interacting with computers. It's about how we should do usability testing with them.
Talking about kind of children and smartphones, and there's a lot of discussion in the media around the banning, for example, of smartphones in Australia for under 16s and social media and stuff, and the potential banning of smartphones in schools in the UK. And we hear a lot of conversations, especially amongst parents, about minimizing screen time for children. It seems to be a bit of a Western social narrative about, well, limit the screen time for children. And in my head, the origin is of this concept is describing children in front of a TV screen, and that then translated into mobile phone usage. Thinking about that, do you think there is such a thing as screen time for children?
It's an interesting question. The focus on screen time, I think, is really undermining the debate. I think it's the thing that the people have grabbed hold of, like children are spending too long, and that the length of time is somehow related to the negative impact. And what I think the research has moved on a lot, but maybe the discourse hasn't really moved on. But what the research generally finds is that, there are some activities which might be worse than others. There are some experiences which might cause negative impacts on some children, but there are also some really positive and in some cases really, really vital, important functions from children's tech use and smartphone use. Most of the good research that's taken place now recognizes the different uses rather than the amount of time, and recognizes also that some children are more vulnerable than others to some of the negative effects of the potential negative effects of using phones. But I don't feel like, maybe this is a disservice, but I don't feel like there are many media articles that grapple with those nuances. They fall back on this notion of screen time. And it resonates. So it resonates with the public because they see children on phones all the time, and they often hark back to their own childhoods. You hear that a lot when you do research in this area, where people say, you know, in my day I was out playing in the street kicking football, but now they're just glued to their phones all the time. And I think when you get a media story that resonates with this thing that is very visible, it just reinforces what you think is happening. But I think there is some much better research being conducted on this now that's really trying to properly understand the relationship between what people do with screens and the impacts it might have on their well-being.
And I think that's exactly it. It's about staring at a phone or staring at a screen versus how you're engaging with it. And it goes back to that, what are you using it for? And what kind of gratification is it fulfilling? I've spoken to a couple of people about gaming, for example, and they often say, well, actually, it's not about banning video games cause children to go and shoot because you shoot up in a school. It's about actually there's something more that they're getting from it. And I think that's, I don't know whether it's parents doing that nostalgic, that in my time, I had such an idyllic childhood. And I think, I wonder if it goes back to that memory of, we have this really idealistic memory of our childhood of how lovely it was playing football in the streets. And for my parents, they often used to talk about when I was younger, we did this, and my childhood had no screens in it at all, but they still hearken back to their childhood and how ideal it was. And I wonder if that's part of this whole narrative of, I want my child to have the same child that I did because we're so idyllic in terms of my memory of it, versus they have such a limited childhood, but actually they don't.
I think that does play a part, is that there often feels like a lot of people have that assumption that the conditions they grew up in were ideal, and any changes are concerning, and then change can be scary, and this technology is powerful. So, I mean, I don't think it's wrong to be cautious. But yes, I agree with you. I think sometimes that reflection of that sort of an idyllic childhood probably really wasn't the case. And actually, also, I think another problem with it is this idea you often hear of children should be outside, they should be playing, they should be socializing with others. I think it comes from quite a limited, an empathic view of what family life can be like. So not everybody has safe outside spaces that their children can go and play in. I was very fortunate. I grew up in the countryside and I could roam around quite safely. But that's not the case for everybody or even most people. So I think that's one thing that makes me a bit concerned when I see some of the narrative is that we need to get children outside. It's like, okay, well, they need safe spaces to be outside. They need resources. They need parks. They need things that they can, think to occupy their time. And I had another point to make, but it's gone out of my head. And it was similar. Exactly what it is now.
Well, one thing I was thinking about, because you were talking about how there's a lot of research happening now that's really insightful versus the kind of old traditional screen time conversations. Do you think it's really the role of academics to get the insight out into the public realm? And do you think as academics and scholars are kind of failing ourselves? And I knew that very loose term, loosely failing in terms of getting that out into the real world, because it does take so long for those insights to get out into the mass media.
Yeah, I think there's a good point in there, and but I do think also academia is changing, and there is a lot more recognition of that need to not just have your findings contained within journal articles. So I do see a lot more effort being made to try and translate findings into more kind of accessible language. But I also think, I don't think it's just the failings of the academics, because people get into academia because they're interested in science, so they're good at designing and analyzing data and things. Why should they also have to be public communicators? I think it's also a failing sometimes of the journalists. It's not an uncommon experience that you'd be interviewed by a journalist about your study and you'd go into lots of details and then it's repackaged. And I understand the pressure. I understand why it happens, but it's repackaged something, with a attention grabbing headline, And then a lot of the nuances of the study are lost in the story. And, you know, if we, it's not really journalists' fault, but there's a systemic issue there, and like the wider attention economy about the pressures of getting people to look at your webpage or look at your story. And I think a lot of people as well, they consume headlines on social media, and they don't click through to the article, but they feel like they know what the article is about. And so sometimes it's not the journalist's fault. It's just the people's online behaviors, the infinite scroll. Oh, I saw another thing about screen time causes this and screen time affects this.
I think you're right. I do. Just when you're saying that, I think I have to exactly that. I read the headline and I just scroll through the headlines, go, oh, I've caught up. I'm fine.
I'm saying this, but I'm as guilty as anybody else for doing that.
Yeah. And headlines are often clickbaits in order to get someone to go to the web page so that the media company can get revenue, because that's how they make money, is about you engaging, having attention and eye time on the screen, really.
Yeah.
So fascinating stuff. So rather than a blanket ban for children for mobile phones or social media, what strategies do you think might promote healthy digital engagement for young people?
Yeah. So the ban is, that sort of blanket ban is a concern. I do think for some young people, I mean, for all young people, most young people will get something that is important to them. But I think for some young people who might be really isolated, I'll give you an example. You know, I'm gay and I grew up in a rural area as a gay teenager. And I think how useful it would have been for me to be able to have more visibility over my community and connect to people online. But I didn't, you know, and it wasn't awful, but it was challenging to kind of discover my identity and navigate all that sort of stuff. And I think that is one area, and there'll be many others, many parallels, where having access to these role models or these communities will be really important to young people. And the other thing I think that needs to be considered is that you might ban access to this technology for under 16-year-olds, but then when they're 16, they're suddenly going to be released into a world where this is ubiquitous. So how are they socialized into that? So I think the strategies, more can be done to have more healthy design strategies. So there are various kind of design features of social sites, for instance, which don't really encourage people to have kind of healthy managed relationships with the content. We talked about the kind of the snapshot headline sort of things, but then like the infinite scroll, it's, you know, there's never a bottom, so you keep going, you know. You know, that things like Snapchat, when they have the snap streaks, you know, that's a design feature that encourages maybe an unhealthy relationship with the technology. So these kind of what we would call deceptive design strategies, I think more can be done to call those out and regulate those. And then the other area is in digital literacy. So helping young people to understand what's real, what's fake, to help them to reflect on how it makes them feel, to understand what, to help them to recognize what is a healthy behavior for them. Those kinds of strategies, I think, are really important. So I'm in the camp of not banning, not restricting, but supporting and giving people skills, digital literacy skills and resilience.
I often talk to people in terms of digital literacy about, you wouldn't give someone the keys to a car if he's never driven and say, go wild, we'll see you later. You teach them how to drive and you do it over time and you sit with them in the car while they're learning how to navigate and change gears and steer and check their mirrors. And the same way with young children, you don't let them loose on the streets. You give them street smart skills that they know how to cross the road and they know to look left, right, left again, or whichever way they need to look. And we teach them that before we let them do it on their own. And I think we forget that the online world is a different world. It's a new type of learning that we need to teach them. And I think we forget that as adults, that you can't just let them loose into this world.
Yeah, I like the analogy with the car. That's a good one. I'll use that.
Oh, you're welcome. During our initial chat, you spoke about the challenges parents face with negotiating tech use in families and how we can make sense of technology when it comes to parenting. Because you spoke about tech as both a lifeline or kind of a babysitter versus the impact technology may have on children. And could you explain how parental tech use influences children from what you called an ecological systems perspective?
The work that we've done with colleagues at Salford, Jenna Taylor, my colleague, and she does a lot of work on children and family, and Amy Bidgood, who was at Salford. We looked at parental family media use during lockdown. And we did some qualitative analysis on parents' reports of kind of how technology has affected them within the family. And I mean, a lot of it you would expect. It was a very unsettling time, quite chaotic time as work sort of routines moved into the home and children's schooling moved into the home. And so technology became like a massive part of how that happened within families. And one thing that came through really strongly in that is that parents felt enormously guilty about the amount of technology their children were using, but they had to really rely on it for enabled to get their own work done. And it was very hard to negotiate that because also children were being required to use technology to do their homework. So, you know, drawing the boundaries around what was acceptable use and what wasn't acceptable use was really difficult. And a lot of the normal media regulation strategies that families might have had in place, they kind of just disintegrated in all the chaos of lockdown. And parents felt just this enormous, like enormously guilty about it and this massive concern about what this tech use was doing. And some of the parents commented on the discourses that they had picked up around screen time was, you know, frequently oriented to. And it just made me think about the pressures that where these messages come from, these kind of this discourse, where it comes from, and the pressures that parents are under. We weren't looking too much at the effects on children in that research. It was more about how families were navigating this kind of complex landscape of technology.
Because it is really complex. I'm guessing that a lot of parents kind of, and they tell their children or give the children boundaries of screen time or tech use, and their screen time and tech use doesn't merge with that same narrative. And I wonder, part of developmental psychology is really around children often copy behavior of adults. And if a parent is standing there in the kitchen scrolling and then telling their child, well, you can't look at social media, it's not really good for you, what kind of things are they teaching the children? It's kind of do what I say, not do what I do. And I wonder if there's a real disconnect with that. And I think it must be really tricky for parents to negotiate that, especially if they're doing hybrid or remote working.
Yeah. I think it's also possible, important to comment on the fact that a lot of families are able to successfully integrate technology in kind of healthy ways where they're using things together. There are lots of stories about families like introducing during lockdown like a film night, or they would research something together. You know, they'd go on the internet and they'd work together and find out about something. So technology did support a lot of a lot of the leisure activities that were restricted because of lockdown. The technology had sort of reintroduced those, and also, of course, allowed everyone to connect outside of the household with family and with friends. So it was a massive lifeline. And it what felt sad to me was the guilt that a lot of the parents were reporting, when actually what they were doing was, you know, they didn't have any choice because of the pressures they were under, and they were kind of overlooking all the benefits that were being brought in as well.
But isn't that also, if they're doing family TV night, that's the healthy side of digital literacy, of this is how you do digital health in a healthy way. It's by engaging as a family and building memories together. Although we might not be talking, we're still doing this together. And it's a different thing of a child alone in their bedroom staring at a screen.
Yeah, it is. But I also worry about this messaging as well, because I think it's a luxury that a lot of families don't have, is the time to engage as a family in those kinds of activities. You know, I think it's a discourse. It's often a kind of a recommendation that you see at the end of these kind of articles, you know, like spend time as a family doing this. I think it rests on this assumption that we just have these like evenings free, where we can just, okay, let's all watch a film together or like have a gaming session or whatever. I think family life can be much more pressured than that. It can be much more difficult. It's not always possible to find time to do that. And just laying on the guilt with parents saying, well, you really need, you know, you should be mediating and regulating your children's media use. I mean, I think that's an enormous ask. A lot of the time, the children are doing things that the parents don't really understand. So how should they be expected to kind of mediate and regulate and explain and, you know, explain to the child what's going on and they don't know themselves? So yeah, there's a lot of nuance and complexity to this, I think.
While you're saying that, I was thinking that actually a lot of those things that are hints and tips at the end of articles can actually be really like a moral dilemma that parents have to then struggle with and kind of go, well, I have to do this and this is what I have to do in order to manage my children's screen time or my screen time, instead of it being giving them permission to find a good balance and find their own way through it. It's helping them through it rather than telling them what to do. And that's a hard thing to do because I think a lot of it is that we don't quite know exactly what is the right thing to do. And how do you help rather than tell?
I know, it's tricky.
One of the things that we spoke about during our initial conversation was the convergence of transhumanism and post-humanism and how it's shaping our relationship with technology. And what this really interests me, because I've been doing quite a lot of reading and watching of YouTube videos about the kind of the Silicon Valley tech entrepreneurs who are kind of wanting to live forever and using technology to integrate into their lives so that they can be immortal. And I'm kind of over exaggerating, but it is, there kind of seems to be a real tech human convergence and part of the narrative of what they think about. So I'm really interested in understanding and your perspective on how and transhumanism and posthumanism are shaping our relationship with technology.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? And so I suppose there's various antecedents of this, you know, so we spoke before about my research on prostheses. Yeah. So I do research on upper limb prosthetics. I'm quite interested in how people experience prosthetic arms, or whether they feel like it's a part of them. And then over the last decade or so, there's been a really kind of ramping up of interest in brain-computer interfaces. So these are computers that can be controlled directly from people's thoughts and their neural activity. And so I think that there's been a lot of interest in that. So that's created this kind of idea or this goal that, you know, if we can interface directly with the brain, then we can get the brain to control tools that are added onto our body. And I think it's opened up the kind of exploratory space, like how might we all augment our bodies? What might it look like to be a human in the future? And then the key area is artificial intelligence. So artificial intelligence obviously has enormous promise and enormous power. And there's a lot of conversation around how humans will collaborate or work alongside AI and about the human in the loop. So what tasks does the AI take on? What tasks does the human take on? And I think some of this has naturally gravitated towards a kind of exploration of a more symbiotic relationship, you know, seamless integration between our own thoughts and what the AI does, what that might look like in the future. So I think these kind of foundational concepts of people are really excited, scared about what that might mean to be a human in the future.
And I'd love to chat about your research on prosthetic arms, but I just want to first ask you, what kind of ethical dilemmas do you think will potentially emerge as these concepts transition from kind of theory into everyday life?
There's fears around warfare, use of these sort of technologies in warfare. But I think the major one is the possibility that if there's an economic divide where people can afford to augment their bodies and what they do will help them to get ahead. So let's take the example of like plugging an intelligence module that suddenly makes you super competent, but you have to pay for that. And then some people can't pay for that. So the people who are wealthy enough to plug in this intelligence module will be able to get further ahead in life. And so the divide between the haves and the have not will grow. So I think that's a really big ethical dilemma here.
The other one, of course, is sustainability in the climate. So AI takes an enormous amount of power, enormous amount of cooling for these huge rate servers that power their power AI. So that's another ethical dilemma. You know, I don't know the stats, but every single tiny search that we do, you know, has a big, massive, great kind of impact. So that's another ethical aspect that needs to be considered.
Yeah, I have heard that same thing. It takes a huge amount. And the more AI, the better the AI is, the more power it takes. So the kind of the deep research that ChatGPT now offers is hugely energy consuming.
Yeah. So it's complex because I think AI also has the potential to help us to solve or explore strategies in relation to, say, the climate. You know, churning about huge amounts of data to help us understand climate patterns could help us to produce efficient kind of or manage efficiencies of our energy consumption, for instance. So there's interesting discussion about the kind of the pros and the cons and whether the benefits outweigh. But I think, I mean, what I see is people just chucking queries into their large language models and not using a very kind of effective prompts, and then getting not an answer that's helpful. So chucking another one in, and, you know, and without an awareness of every single time that an answer is generated for them, with the huge energy costs of that query.
That's interesting, because I wonder if there's going to become a kind of narrative around, you know, with the whole recycling of plastics and glass and tin. We went from throwing everything away to actually recycling everything. And I wonder if there's going to be some element of awareness, a bigger quantity of awareness around the cost, the environmental cost or the energy cost of AI. So therefore, how are you using it? Are you being thoughtful? And or go and plant a tree, go do a deep research project, go plant a tree while you're doing it.
Yeah, I think that hopefully that's already started. So I see that being raised more and more often. So at university, I've heard students questioning that. So which I think is really good. You know, there might be a lazy assumption that students are using AI, you know, really frequently, you know, to support their work. But, you know, it's nice to hear them questioning the climate impacts of that. And certainly in meetings I've had where people have been talking about AI, climate has become quite quickly has come onto the table as a one topic of conversation. So I think you're right. I like the analogy with recycling. Hopefully that, you know, it will become synonymous. While we're thinking about AI, we'll also simultaneously be thinking about the impact.
Yeah. So be better at prompting, so you only use it once rather than three times, or how do you recycle information, or just do upfront work before you actually just chuck a whole bunch of things in.
Yeah. And do more work teaching people how to be good at prompting.
Yes. And that's, I think that's the key, because there's there's quite a lot of fear around AI and the use of AI and what is it for? It's going to steal my job. So I think a lot of people struggle to use it or get engaged in it because there is that fear of self-preservation in a way, but actually, how do I use it? I've got ChatGPT on my screen, but how do I actually, what do I do with it? Do I use it like Google? So there's just isn't that digital literacy yet, I think, the understanding of the environment's impact, as you say.
Yeah.
So let's go back to your work with prosthetic arms. And I'm struggling to say that you shot prosthetic arms. How does your research offer a unique window into the concept of the extended mind? And we spoke about that briefly during our initial chat. And it's fascinating for me, having read kind of stuff about the extended mind and how we see things with prosthetics. So can you talk about that a bit more?
So my work on prosthetics again is linked back to, and initially was linked back to, my eye tracking work. So we've got a really great prosthetics team at Salford University, and I started collaborating with them, understanding how people were using vision to control their limbs. So we did a lot of eye tracking work, people wearing prosthetic limbs and reaching forward, picking up a carton, pouring it, and working out where they were directing their vision. And that was helped us understand the kind of the learning process and also the cognitive effort involved in doing that kind of activity.
And then over the years, I've worked with mostly PhD students on projects like, do people experience their prosthetic limb as a part of their body? Or do they see it as something that they can just take on and off, and it doesn't feel like a part of their body? And the kind of the headlines from that research is it varied. Different people have different experiences. Some people want that, some people don't want that. But that was really interesting because that got me to think about the more sort of socio-emotional, psychological, and identity-related aspects of prostheses. So I've done a lot of work on kind of psychoprosthetics, like understanding people's psychological experience. The extended mind stuff, I haven't really linked that concept with prosthetic arm use, but that is something that I explore with my students in when I teach cyber psychology, and the kind of the way that a lot of our cognitive activities take place externally to our mind or to our brains or the kind of our biological head. And we use tools to externalize some of that cognitive activity. You know, even like counting on our fingers with glasses, using a tool to externalize cognitive activity, and language as well is an external tool. You know, verbalizing things helps us solve problems. And that's an example of that too. But it becomes really interesting when we think about smartphones as a sort of external memory device. And it also becomes super interesting when we think about artificial intelligence and as what we would call cognitive offloading tool, whereby, you know, if we are working alongside artificial intelligence in a, let's say, a symbiotic way, we offload some of our thinking and activities onto the artificial intelligence, and the artificial intelligence does some of that processing for us. And then I think the ultimate aim that some people have discussed is that this, you know, it feels very natural, and the activities and the different cognitive components will flow from our brain to the AI. And, you know, so that's how we've explored the extended mind in the course.
Okay. Because there isn't, part of, I know you don't do kind of self-perception, but I'm starting to kind of read a lot about that in terms of how we perceive the extension of ourselves, and just in terms of prosthetics that I'm just fascinated, and you may not have the answer to this, but I'm just fascinated how people see where they end and their technology ends, or if the technology becomes part of them, especially with teenagers, I guess, or young people who, when you ask them to put their phone down, they feel at a loss that like something's been from them. And I'm just really fascinated by how they see that technology as part of themselves. And I think it also goes back to what you talk about with cognitive offloading. It's just, this becomes a way of expressing yourself outside of yourself, and then how that then is seen as integral to who you are as a person. So, I'm kind of putting it back to the prosthetics in terms of how we see that being part of who we are and our own identity.
I mean, I think there's a lot of levels that you can answer that question from. So with something like a prosthetic limb or like a wheelchair, people can subjectively feel like that the limb or the wheelchair is a part of their body. So studies of wheelchair users find that they perceive the width of their body to align with the wheelchair. So that relates to what we call their body schema. So the way that the brain represents what is a part of your body and not a part of your body. So we can look at it from that kind of level. We call that embodiment, or it might be a phenomenological thing, or it might be a neural thing in terms of the way our brain is representing where our body is. In terms of what you were saying around smartphones and identity, I think one of the really, that's a different kind of question, I think. But one of the things that is really interesting is the way that social media sites, for instance, allow people to explore their identities and try out different identities, get validation for the way they present themselves. And so there's a lot of learning that people can do about themselves from the way that people respond to the way that they've, and then you can explore different presentations of yourself. So this conversation often comes alongside understanding adolescent social media use, like why do adolescents spend so long on social media?
One of the key tasks of adolescence is kind of establishing an identity, and that can be your personal identity, like who I am, or your social identity, like where do I belong. And social media provides a kind of a really accessible way of testing these kinds of things.
But that goes back to something you were saying earlier about exploring your identity, exploring who you are, especially if you grow up in a kind of country, a small environment where expressing yourself or expressing who you feel you are, that goes slightly against the odds of the majority of people in that area. Actually, on social media, it provides that space for you to explore this aspect of who you are, and kind of can give you confidence in understanding this is who I am and I'm okay with it, rather than having to kind of hide it or pretend to be something that you don't feel you are.
And find role models as well.
You know, having similar to you.
Yeah, exactly. Or similar to what you want to be. And it allows you to test your own kind of your desired identity through seeing other people and, you know, and realizing that they can be happy, that they did overcome the kind of the discomfort of growing up gay, and then they found themselves. You know, that kind of role model can be really, really important for young people, I think.
Yeah, good for mental health and well-being.
Yeah.
Okay, so moving on to some of the research that you're involved in around texting in the brain, specifically looking at the difference between the cognitive processing of face-to-face communication versus text-based communication. So what did you find in that research, and why is it important? And how do you think we can build tools to aid in having a more naturalistic experience of text-based communication?
So that project was one of my master's students, Raul Sacristan. It was his passion project. He really, really wanted to study neural activation while texting. So he used some of our brain imaging kits called FNIRS, functional near infrared spectroscopy. It's like a band that people wear across their head. And it's quite useful technology because people can engage in other activities at the same time as we're measuring their brain activity. The study was quite simple in concept. He got people to engage in either a conversation over text, so they were separated in two rooms, they had a conversation on WhatsApp, or they had the same conversation face-to-face. They were in one condition or the other. And he measured the brain activity of one of the participants in each of those two different contexts. And he was looking in particular at areas in the prefrontal cortex, so in front of our brains, that are involved in social processing, so social cognition, understanding your communication partner. And essentially what he one of the interesting things that I think he found was that activity in one of these social cognitive brain areas during face-to-face communication, it grew during the process of the conversation, whereas the text-based communication, it didn't really grow. It grew, but at a much shallower rate. And the way that we interpreted this finding was that during face-to-face communication, so this particular area of the brain he was looking at has been implicated before in kind of understanding emotional cues and social cues of your communication partner. The way we interpreted that finding was that during face-to-face communication, you start to pick up more kind of important cues about your communication partner. You start to understand them better. You can build empathy with them better. And therefore, this brain area becomes increasingly implicated during your communication. But there's fewer social cues during texting. So that was the kind of the main takeaway from that finding. But what I think is useful from that is, I think if we can understand what successful communication is, and if we can understand how these social cognitive brain areas, what the correlates are of successful communication, then we can start to try and use that to understand how to use technology to facilitate, you know, some of the important features of communication, like synchronizing with your communication partner. That's something that people do when they're talking. They get to know when there's a pause, when they should speak. They get to kind of develop a rhythm in sort of turn taking and things like that. So if we can understand how technology can support some of those features of communication, then maybe we can start to design technology in that way.
Do you think emojis play a part in that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I know you've had Linda Kay on this before, haven't you? So she is the absolute expert on emoji processing. We didn't isolate emojis for our analysis, although some of our participants did use them. So this is coming from a non-expert perspective. Emojis can add emotional valence to a message, and they can help to disambiguate something that is just was in purely text form to show what emotion is being intended through that messaging. But they also, because they're kind of discrete categories, I think have the potential to decomplexify. No, that's probably not the right word. But when you are talking to somebody face to face, you might experience a whole run of different emotions which can be conveyed during your communication. But if you just try and simplify that to one smiley face, one sad face, I think that does. There's a word that is hovering somewhere just outside of my consciousness, but I can't grab it.
No, but that kind of makes sense from the perspective of it. It helps to convey some of what you would try to put across in body language or facial expressions or tone of voice. So emojis can help with that, but obviously don't have the richness of emotions and tone of voice and cadence and body language, but it can help. So it probably wouldn't. Yeah, also non-expert opinion. It's just, and I don't think it would add the same level of richness and build that to the same degree, but it might help aid. And I also wonder if you know someone quite well and you know how they speak in person, then you probably read their emotions and you read their tone of voice when you actually looking at words. Yeah. Now, you've been doing psychology for a couple of years now, actually almost a couple of decades. But it's still actually a really young field in the world of psychology in general. What do you think are the most exciting areas of research now? And where do you see the field heading in the next 5 to 10 years?
So I think the field is very much heading down the artificial intelligence route. And I think rightly so. You know, it's revolutionizing so many aspects of our lives, and it's really, really powerful technology, and it has huge, great ethical and moral dilemmas for psychologists and other disciplines to try and solve, or to, you know, try and steer into a future that we want and away from a future that we don't want. So I think that's definitely a huge part of it. I'm gonna just say that.
Just leave it there. And I wonder also, with you talking about transhumanism, if that's also going to become part of it, is just how are we integrating this technology, not just from an AI perspective. And what impacts it and have on ourselves. So, Adam, we're coming to the end of our chat. And one of the questions I normally ask the guests at the end is, what is the most crucial question I haven't asked you yet and that you believe we need to consider?
So it's a great question, that, and I've been thinking about that this afternoon. And I think I think that the debates around decolonization in higher education are really important and also applied to this field as well. So I think that there are a small number of sites in the world where most of this research is coming from. And I think it often is assumed that findings from one part of the world can just be generalized to other parts of the world. So I think that is really a really important feature or an important challenge of cyber psychology. But I also think it relates to a lot of the cyber psychology research suffers from the same limitations as psychology at large, which is that a lot of the participants are those that are available to the researchers. And they tend to be university students. They tend to be psychology students even. And so we learn a lot from testing people who are just like us. And then we make claims that these findings generalize to other populations. And I think that this is really important in cyber psychology because this research feeds into the way technologies are designed. And I think that the tech
industry suffers from the same limitations as well. So we produce technology in one location in the world and we farm it out to another location in the world, and we assume that what works for this population will also work for this population. And I think that that's a big challenge to be solved. And there are some, you know, really fantastic people who are writing about this and challenging this and getting me to think about this. So that's where I would push. This is what we need to be talking about.
That's a really good point, because when I was doing our master's, I was doing technology use amongst adults in the workplace. And I really struggled to find research that was workplace adults. It was mostly lecturers and students. And as you said, it's kind of the population that's easily accessible. And it is tricky to then extrapolate those insights into a work-based context or corporate context.
Yeah.
We need more research outside academia.
Yeah. I think a lot more, and I think it is happening as well, because I think the points I've made, I mean, I'm not the first person to make these points. People are shouting this as loudly as they can. But this, like, you need to get out and reach all different communities. And understand their needs and their values and their behaviors and their technologies and their routines. And we need to design for everybody, or we need to make technology accessible to everybody, not just based on, 20 psychology students were able to complete this activity really successfully. And then, you know, you also see it in the kind of the UX usability field. I mean, there are a lot of great UX usability researchers, but there's also a lot of very poor research, which is based on just panels of participants that are kind of reached very conveniently online, or people that are accessible to the team. It's a wide issue, I think.
That's a really good point. On a lighter note, and do you have any must-read cyber psychology books that you are particularly interested in or inspired you, or that you think are essential for anyone to read in your specific area of media or cyber psychology?
Yeah, I do. I've got a pile of them right here next to me. And they stem from the point I just made, actually, some of them. So I don't know if you've come across this text, Invisible Women. Okay, so this is about how a lot of design and a lot of science is based on male bodies or research with males, and therefore doesn't serve women. You know, the most well-known example is the design of seatbelts being designed for male bodies and not women's bodies. But this book is filled with examples, and some of that is about tech design. So I draw from this book when I'm teaching about the importance of empathy in technology. So that's the first one, Invisible Women. And then another one that I've got, which I think tells us or makes a similar argument, is called Design Justice. This is a really great book, and this is all about making sure that tech is designed for marginalized communities. And really discusses the relationship between design and power and justice. And so I think that's a really good book as well. And then what else have I got here in my pile? So this was a really super enjoyable read. It's called Wonderland. And this is all about how humans striving for playful experiences and for novel experiences has driven a lot of human history. So it's not just a trivial aspect of what it means to be human. Actually, our drive for novel experiences has shaped the way that humans have evolved, or culture has evolved. Really, really super interesting. Not all of it is like directly relevant to media or technology, but some of it is, and it certainly shaped my thinking. I'll leave it with those three.
That's brilliant, because that's the thing, is that there's so much that's not technology focused and books that actually add so much value into how we see our engagement with technology. So thank you very much for sharing those. Adam, thank you so much for joining me in Confessions of the Cyber Psychologist. It was so great chatting to you, and I hope we get to talk again in the future about the work that you're doing and the research that you're involved in.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.